This is Remote But Not Restricted, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology and the Thomas Pocklington Trust.
Hello and welcome into episode number 33 of Remote But Not Restricted, looking at institutional supports for visually impaired students. My name is Stuart Lawler, and on today's show, our Head of Education, Caroline Smith, is here, and we're meeting an organisation called All Able. Well, it really is great to be back on Remote But Not Restricted. It's been quite a while, and yet we're on episode 33. I hope everybody is keeping well. There is a real sense of normality coming back, I think, talking to people in the last couple of days who are going back to college. I'm actually meeting somebody later this afternoon as we record, who's getting some technology training in advance of starting face-to-face learning next week. So things do seem to be looking up. And we thought that by way of starting this episode, I suppose I should check in with the lady who's kind of become known as our series producer, one of her many hats, and we'll talk about other hats in a sec, but it's Head of Education, Caroline Smith. Caroline, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Stuart. It's great to be back.
I have to ask, because everybody else will ask, where are you?
I'm in a very echoey room at our new office in Northampton, which is actually the kitchen. I feel like I've been demoted somewhat, but every other room was taken in the building this morning. But yes, the kitchen is, or the glamour.
Okay. Yeah, I have yet to be in the new Sight and Sound office, although I'm coming over in a couple of weeks. Listen, I just thought it was good to catch up with you to maybe contextualize where we are. We met a lot of people on the podcast. If you look back over 32 episodes, and indeed our last one was with Conor Hartigan in the University of Limerick. And Caroline, I know you're very friendly with the guys down in the University of Limerick.
Yes, I have the good fortune to deal with Thomas more than I have with Connor. Not that I don't want to deal with Connor, but I speak with Thomas a lot. We do a lot of assistive technology quoting for products and services for him. So I help. We speak regularly. He always comes up with like the weirdest and most wonderful technology that sometimes is coming from across the pond in America. So he likes to keep us on our toes and challenge us in trying to source some of this stuff. But it's always interesting to hear from Thomas because he's a lively chap.
He's a great guy. Big shout out to Thomas and Connor, who do great stuff in the University of Limerick. So Caroline, I suppose I just wanted to maybe reflect with you for a sec, because we both attended the NADEX exhibition last week. We're going to hear in a couple of minutes from the guys from All Able, Georgia and Ben. What was it like for you attending a very busy face-to-face show?
Do you know, it just felt like a bit like normality, Stuart. I mean, it was absolutely lovely to see you and our other colleagues, Scott and Anthony and our CEO, Glenn. But it was lovely to actually interact with people again, because I actually saw a few friendly faces, people I haven't seen for, a couple of years, actually, which when you put it into that context, it seems like forever, doesn't it? But it was so nice to interact with the general public as well, obviously in a very secure COVID secure way. It was amazing, and it was so well organized as well. Although we did reflect on it, didn't we? And we thought that the footfall was down because people are still being very cautious with events of that nature, and particularly it being NADEX, their target audience are obviously slightly more vulnerable. So, but there was a lot of people there. I mean, it was great. Lots of people in wheelchairs. That was the thing. Almost sometimes I felt like I was going to be run over, which was fun.
there was plenty of wheelchairs. You know, for me, what was interesting, Caroline, is that you and I have been talking for probably 18 months online, and then you very kindly offered to meet me at the train station. So I came out of the airport, got the shuttle across to the train station, and there you were. And it was like, my God, this is Caroline in person as opposed to Caroline on Zoom. And even for someone with no vision, that's a hugely powerful thing, I think.
Yeah, it was really slick and seamless, wasn't it? It was all meant to be. It was like a lovely dance that we did together. But no, Stuart, I swear, it was just an absolute pleasure to see you again. And I can't wait to see more of our contacts, our colleagues, people that have been involved in the podcast series since the start of the pandemic, because it would be great to be able to actually interview people face-to-face again, like we did with the All Able guys. That was fun.
On that note, Caroline, because I know a lot of what you do is getting out, and I always joke, you kind of hugging and kissing people, but you know, you get out and meet people because that's what you do so well. Are you starting to do more of that, or is there more on campus? Are you hearing more that people want to get back to face-to-face?
I wish I was saying yes. I'm desperate to go and see more people, actually. Even when we were our colleague Ruth and I were up in Scotland recently, and the guys that we were meeting, we had to meet off campus because visitors still weren't allowed on site, which was it was incredible. So we'd just go locally for a nice cup of coffee and a chat and a catch up, which was quite nice. We saw our friends at the University of Dundee and some other institutions as well. But no, I mean, there are other events happening. So I'm attending the ATEC conference, which is happening next month in October. So it'll be a lot of hugging and a kissing there, I think, Stuart.
Okay. So
good. That's a lot more normality for me.
Okay. So listen, well, that's all great. And I know we'll check in with you every so often to see what you're doing. There's always interesting stuff going on in the education space with Sight and Sound. But I need you to take off the Sight and Sound hat for a moment and your series producer hat and put on your BATA hat. Because since we spoke last, you've been appointed as the executive director of BATA. Is that correct?
Yes. So just to add to my workload, because obviously that's what everyone loves to do, I was appointed at the beginning of the 1st of April. I became the executive director of the British Assistive Technology Association for my sins. So it's been, I'm 6 months in, and it's just been pretty much a whirlwind. It's only one day a week on top of my Sight and Sound responsibilities. So it's not like I've left Sight and Sound, I've not gone anywhere. But no, the BATA experience has been interesting. There's been a lot going on in terms of like housekeeping, getting ourselves in order, because my objectives are to raise awareness of the organization. We want to build on our member base. We have about 108 members currently, and they cover the whole of the assistive technology sector, from end users to institutions, publishers, manufacturers of assistive technology, producers, suppliers like Sight and Sound. And, it's really interesting because we're trying to cover quite a lot of the sector area by engaging with our special interest groups, of which there are 9 currently, from AAC technologies right through to visual impairment technologies. It's really interesting stuff. And I know that I've been getting you and our colleagues involved in the visual impairment special interest group, because that's newly launched in the last 6 months as well. So there's lots of stuff going on there. And I'm just getting started though, Stuart. You know what I'm like.
I know what you're like. It sounds to me, Caroline, like a really interesting time to be taking on a role like that, because look, we've said it on this podcast loads of times before, COVID has impacted so much of what we do, but it's impacted how we access and how we use, I suppose, technology and related services. So I think you're going to be kept very busy.
Yes, I am. I'm excited. You know, I've got, I'm building a good team of people around me, and, it's exciting times. If anyone has any questions that they want to have answered or anything like that, then they can always look to the BATA website for information. We have it's www.bataonline.org is the web address, and it has lots and lots and lots of helpful information there, links to our members. You can ask questions, lots of good information and stuff for anyone that is a user of assistive technology.
Okay. We like lots of good information and stuff. Definitely, Caroline. Want to keep in touch with you and keep an eye on all the goings on with your many hats, but we appreciate your busy. So thanks a million for sort of, I guess, helping us to relaunch this new series of podcasts on Remote But Not Restricted. And we'll catch up with you very soon.
Okay. Thank you, Stuart. It's absolutely a pleasure as always.
You're listening to Remote But Not Restricted, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology and the Thomas Pocklington Trust.
Well, we're still here at the NADEX exhibition, but because Caroline, who, of course, as we mentioned earlier, is our series producer, has found us 3 really interesting people who have set up an organisation called All Able. And we only heard about this you guys about an hour ago, but we have Ben, George, and Georgia. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I think this is the second interview we've done on this podcast that has actually been face-to-face, because everything has been so online. So it's really nice to sit down with you guys, and we appreciate your time. Ben, we'll talk about All Able in a sec and maybe how it all came about. But just tell us a little bit about yourself and your own background. And I might ask each of you that. So Ben, we'll start with yourself.
Great, thank you. I began my career in as a teacher trainer at the Royal London Society for the Blind. They had a place called Dorton House School and Dorton College. And I got really interested in information and how we access information. And this is going back 20 years or so, when it was not really a given that information would be accessible to people, when people didn't necessarily know how to make information accessible. Part of that was that we supported young people with visual impairment in the local further education college, and it became really clear when you had visually impaired students in a kind of mainstream classroom doing things like travel and tourism, that the lecturers providing class notes and things like that had absolutely no idea how to make them accessible. That kind of concern about that never went away. I didn't pursue teaching for the reason that lots of people don't pursue teaching. I went into librarianship, but I saw the same things happening there around electronic delivery of resources, that the structures that were being put in place for the physical environment, like ramps and lifts, weren't being replicated for the digital environment. And so my interest in it has never gone away since then, and I continue to campaign for better in digital resources, because I think it can be better. And the technology is there now to genuinely support a really inclusive environment.
Okay, and we'll come back to talk about all that in a couple of seconds. Okay. George, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you started off and maybe came to this journey.
No problem. My journey into the accessibility sphere, almost completely different to Ben's, polar opposite, but at the same time, in that same way, where eventually you just wake up one morning and someone tells you you do accessibility now, and that becomes your job. So my background sits far more in local government and various other aspects of the public sector. I used to mainly focus on partnership work. So I started out my career in a little partnership venture between the Kent County Council and the various other districts and boroughs and emergency services and things down in Kent, called Kent Connects. Shout out to my old crew back then. And I got introduced to accessibility through some really great colleagues of mine who worked on the Equality Act back in the day, and they introduced me to, at the time, what was coming in as the public sector body's accessibility regulations. I'd had some dealing with it previously. A lot of the partnership work I'd done had introduced me to many of the inclusive sort of design concepts, etc. But it wasn't until these regulations came into effect that I found something that I happened to be really, really interested in. And through a series of events, which included a great amount of righteous indignation, I got very annoyed that people were not planning to comply with this regulation as much as was really required. And we're still seeing that today, that levels of compliance with these regulations on websites and in any other digital services that are used to support students or staff or members of the public, it's just not where it needs to be yet. So I ended up looking at thousands of accessibility statements under the regulations. I wrote a few articles about the fact that nobody was complying, and about how one of the clauses in the regulations regarding disproportionate burden was being heavily misused by a lot of people. One thing led to another, and I ended up talking about that in a Cabinet Office roundtable meeting in front of the Director General, and then I ended up giving talks for the European Commission about it shortly afterwards. So one thing led to another, and here I am.
Here you are. Okay.
Doing accessibility.
Okay, and we'll talk in a second about how you guys all got together and formed what you're doing now. Georgia, what's brought you to this journey? What did you start out doing?
Well, I work in engagement and communications in student support in higher education, and that's how I ended up meeting Ben and George. So I work a lot on social media and web pages to make sure that actual content is accessible, and it's just sort of overtaken a lot of my job role because I enjoy it so much.
So guys, I think there's an interesting backstory. I get the impression before we came on air, you guys mentioned something, because we love backstories on this podcast, as Caroline Smith will probably say as well. How did you guys set up All Able? How did it come to be? How are we all sitting here today?
To us, an interesting story.
Okay.
There are several chapters in it, but yeah,
give us the 2-minute version.
I will give you the abridged version. So myself and Ben were working in two very different circles to begin with. Through a chance meeting and over a pint, we got introduced to each other, found a kindred spirit who also cared about accessibility as much as the other did, and we started doing a lot more work together. In the first instance, it was to benefit our local communities. So where I was doing the partnership work and where Ben was working at the local university, we started combining our efforts to provide better guidance, to push on more accessible learning materials, more accessible comms or services and things for the local authorities. And myself and Ben started getting invited out to more and more talks, start getting invited to give our thoughts on things and comment on different bits of guidance and various other bits and pieces. Mm. And in the end, me and Ben said, why don't we turn this into a business? Why don't we start getting paid for some of the additional work that we do? And so that's how All Able came about. But there is another interesting chapter to the story about how really all of us sort of started off our PhDs within the realms of accessibility, mainly through a chance meeting with a old school celeb from the cult film Spinal Tap, which is Ben's absolutely most favourite film in the world. And I'd be hurting him if I took this story away.
Ben, off you go.
Okay, so the film, this is Spinal Tap, as George says, is an absolute favourite one. I can quote quite a few bits of it. And there's a keyboard player in the bits, like they call it a mockumentary about this fake band from the 80s who were like into this heavy metal stadium rock band, and they've got a keyboard player in it called Viv Savage. And my colleague at the university, his mum happened to be best mates with the guy who played Viv Savage in Spinal Tap, and she just some weird random thing, she mentioned that he was coming over, so we ended up inviting him out. We had a drink with him, and it turned in, this evening got a little bit raucous, and we ended up having a kind of audience with Viv Savage, who's a pretty wild character, you can imagine, as a fake rock star would be. And he ended up playing a one-man set for us in a very posh room in the senior common room in the university for us, just between about three or four of us. And some of the Spinal Tap songs have got some quite racy lyrics, so in this kind of refined and splendid, magnificent senior common room, we were listening to some slight risque rock and roll being played on a piano by the guy who played Viv Savage. But the Viv Savage, the reason I love it so much is he has this catchphrase. At the end of the film, they ask him what his philosophy for life is, and he says it's have a good time all the time, which I've tried to live my life by ever since.
Yeah. Brilliant. So, George, can you give us the sort of All Able, your mission statement, what you guys do? Because I know I was reading a little bit today on your website about how you're trying to advocate for people who I suppose use specialist technology,
who have had challenges accessing mainstream services, online services, would that be correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So our all-label tagline, if you like, is helping you help everyone. And we really try to embody this. So it's not just about AT users or disabled users. Given mine and Ben's background, we really, really feel that essential services, you know, those things that we all have to engage with every day, or are really the stepping stones to a you know, happy, successful, independent life. All of these things should really, really be open to everyone. So that's why, you know, we want to make government services accessible. We want to make the NHS accessible. We've been working mainly within the public sector for the past couple of years, mainly dealing with local government, colleges, higher education, NHS. But we're starting to, you know, branch our way out there now into other things which are essential to everyone, but not necessarily always covered by the public sector. So one thing that, you know, we really felt quite passionately about back in the beginning of the lockdowns was the government's listing of essential services, to include obviously supermarkets and online shopping services, that these things still don't have the same demand of them as government services, you know, all of these other services, exactly, you know, all of these things that are essential to everyone still aren't taking the same steps as the rest of the things. But we're trying one step at a time, so we're working with what we can change at the moment. We're trying to make a little bit of a difference, but there's a long road ahead, obviously.
And so, in the, just bringing that out a bit, have you, for example, an essential service in the lockdown might have been, say, the supermarket, but maybe online shopping for some people, I'm just thinking here, say, for example, with screen readers, might have been difficult. Were you trying to encourage that kind of retail sector to look at that? Is that what you're...
We did in part, yeah. So back when all that was going on, the amount of encouragement we could really give as one voice among many is only
sure,
so much.
Sure.
But we did a few things. So I wrote a great... I think it was great. I wrote it, but you know, that's for other people to decide. I wrote an article, which may or may not be great, along with my colleague Nick Jarvis-Smith, who we put together this article to try and challenge some of these assumptions about the essential services and what they're providing. Alongside that, in my regularly viewed research about the levels of compliance for the new regulations and accessibility statements, I started to include the big name supermarkets in that, because most of them have accessibility statements, most of them provide some level of support, but it does vary between each of them. And we have tried several other ways to try and make our voices heard, that these certainly need improvements, but also even physical shopping back in the early lockdown times was very difficult. So I lived directly next to one of our other all-able colleagues, Paul George Ender, who is blind and a cane user. And when we used to go to Sainsbury's and do our shopping together, because it was much easier with all the social distancing for us to go as a pair, we had some terrible experiences in our local supermarket, of which I won't name. You know, even during times where we're supposed to be all pulling together, we had experiences where at one point Paul had his cane kicked out from underneath him because someone needed to get to something, or he's pushed aside because he's standing there and in the way. And you know, even then, it's really basic things that we just want to talk to people and try and change. And so, you know, we have a chat with management and we say, can you do something about this? And to be fair, I have to say, from just a shopper standpoint, some of the messaging that I've heard over tannoys and that about being respectful of others who might have different access needs, who might have different different situations going on, has been amazing to hear for something that was otherwise never discussed in that kind of environment.
And I suppose too, we have to keep in mind that we were, and especially in those early days, pandemic, everything shut down overnight. People were really trying to frantically make this up as they go along, weren't they?
Mm.
So,
and, I think that you wouldn't wish the pandemic again for anything, but I think there's been some really positive things to come out of it, you know, and the adoption of an awful lot of digital practices that previously, certainly in education, we'd been fighting for a long time, like recording lectures and things like that. And now, you know, it feels like that battle's been won. So there are some silver linings to this pretty horrible experience. And I think it's definitely focused people's attention on the accessibility of the digital space, not just thinking about physical spaces.
Let me come to that for a sec then, around this kind of digital online space and the accessibility, because I certainly found in my work, and again, particularly over the first couple of months in the first lockdown, working with some students to navigate online web-based learning systems was really, really tough. I struggled, so they must have, you know, as someone who's trying to learn this on the fly with them, was really tough. Did you guys come across that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So this is something that I'm very pleased you've brought up, because it means we can talk about some research we're currently doing with the Thomas Pocklington Trust, a blind and vision impairment charity. We've currently been, and we will be until the final report is released late October, looking at the levels of student support for blind and vision impaired users in FE colleges across the UK. So we've been looking at all kinds of aspects of the student journey in that respect. So we've been looking at the presence of accessibility statements and the accessibility of main college websites, how people can get prospectuses and get in contact with the college, get their application in, etc. But one of the other things that we've been finding very, very interesting is a bit of a shift lately in VLE usage, or virtual learning environment usage, the back-end systems that mainly are web-based, that students have to use and navigate to submit coursework, etc. The long-standing leaders in that space, both Moodle and Blackboard, we've seen a little bit of a reduction in the use of those recently in favour of other services like Google Classroom and Office 365. Obviously they aren't one-for-one swaps, because they all provide slightly different levels of service, but there has been this move away. There's been a bit of a move to learn more about these platforms by many colleges and universities, and try and provide better accessibility guidance for them. But it's a very interesting situation at the moment.
I think it's about trying to change a culture. So you've got the box in which all those learning resources are housed, and typically that will be provided by a third party. But you've also got the accessibility of the resources that populate that. So the lecture slides, the module handbooks. So that can't be controlled by the third party. That has to be controlled by the academics, the teaching staff who are putting those resources together. So I think there's always historically been a reliance on assistive technology to work like magic to fix all the problems with inaccessible materials. And I think people are starting to realise now that it's a 50-50 effort, in that you can only use assistive technology really effectively where you've made stuff accessible in the first place, so it'll perform well.
And of course, the other part of that puzzle, isn't it, or the other part of that jigsaw, is that the user of assistive technology has to be supported, has to have had the necessary training in that particular tech to be able to maximise its functionality to use the online service or system.
Totally. And we were discussing this earlier, that if you do that, you take the time to make your stuff more accessible, it will perform better with assistive technologies. Why just only show those assistive technologies to people with disabilities? Why don't you just let everybody use those technologies to experience those resources that you've spent lots of time making accessible? Why doesn't everybody benefit from that?
And we'll see the fruits of this research that you guys have been doing with Thomas Pocklington Trust in the next couple of months. Is that right, is it?
Absolutely.
End of October.
Yeah, by the end of October, we're hoping to get the full report out. It's going to include some very telling results about the state of further education college support at the moment. I don't want to give too much away, because I'd like people to read the report, but we're also planning to add in a lot of proactive information into that, which hopefully will help student support services, college leadership,
recommendations for
make some decisions on how to take this forward.
policy makers as well, because the support in further education colleges for students is fantastic. The one-to-one support, the assisted learning support teams are doing a wonderful job with very limited resource. But what we're talking about is a kind of strategy review for colleges as a whole and greater levels of support, so that they can truly adopt inclusive practices rather than always having to work kind of retrospectively and make adjustments for individual students when they could be just adjusting centrally for all students.
Okay, guys, we've touched on loads of things in this century, but there's three more things I want to maybe tease out quickly before we finish. From a communication standpoint and kind of putting information out during the pandemic in particular, how has it been received by the work that you guys are doing? What have people been saying? Are they responding positively?
So George has been doing some wonderful stuff. The significant improvement in comms for the university has been really well received by a lot of students. I know George has had some positive comments back. From a wider perspective, I think it's something that we need to be touching on more. The social media communications, other formats as well, because as you've just brought up, the communications within the time of the pandemic, we've seen many examples from central government and NHS in providing COVID information has not always found its way to everyone in the right formats. And so we're actually really seeing a really positive movement in a lot of the clients that we work with really engaging in understanding how to make their comms better, in how to make not only their social media but anything they put out, any documentation, anything to do with recruitment and HR material as well.
Procurement.
Absolutely, procurement material as well. All moving towards becoming more accessible, which is good to see a real kind of shift in the culture to understand that.
Which is great. Now, I suppose, in somewhat leading on from this, and anybody who wants can answer this, and it kind of struck me as you were talking and also as we were walking up to do this interview, have we still something of a societal problem around accessibility? In that when you mention accessibility, people go, oh yeah, of course, but you almost feel the undertone is, oh my God, not this again. Now we're going to have to do more work. It's a pain in the you-know-what. Is that true, or is that me just thinking?
I think we're on a journey. I think it's a lot better than it was. I think people are at least familiar with what accessibility broadly means now. I mean, we talk a lot about people kind of misinterpreting accessibility to purely just mean availability, like, oh, it's on our website, what more do you want? Whereas that nuance around, well, is it available to everybody who wants to use it on our website, is the kind of next part of that question. I think nobody is hostile to the idea of making stuff accessible. Certainly people who work in the public sector, generally my experience is they are doing it altruistically. I think what people do struggle with is having the time and space to absorb the skills and techniques they need to genuinely make their stuff accessible. I think that is a challenge, and fitting that around their existing workflows is tricky, because people quite often are already working at capacity, and this renewed interest or focus on accessibility for some people feels like it's landed from space, and that's quite a lot for them to absorb. But I don't sense it as a reluctance. I just find it a nervousness to absorb a new skill.
I'd like to come with a counterpoint on that, if that's what
you're we always do good cop,
and there
bad
I was going to think it's all good, but here's the other side. Go on.
Sorry, yeah, good cop, bad cop. So in a counterpoint to Ben, I think we do still have a problem as a society with parts of our whole still not seeing this as a fundamental kind of human right issue. And the reason I think this is because in advocating for this over several years, I've had experiences with, for example, suppliers of IT solutions who have said to me in meetings, we've been doing this for 20 years. Nobody's ever brought up this requirement before. And that particular one blew my mind, because the Equality Act's been around for 10 years and the DDA years before that.
So despite the fact that I agree with Ben in many ways about the fact that there are a lot of practical considerations to getting people to be able to support accessibility, I think we do still have some hang up in a way with certain groups of people not seeing this as something that absolutely obviously should be done. And you know, we need to do, as we've been saying, a bit of a culture shift to make sure that everyone's on board so we can all move forward.
Are you often here, and by the way, this was a private company who I was dealing with last year, but it was in the retail space, guys, and you might be interested to hear, and it was in Ireland, by the way, so not, you know, but there was a shopping app, and I was pointing out some issues around accessibility, and they said, thank you, accessibility is not on our roadmap at the moment.
At the moment. Oh, right. That's reassuring.
Wow. So I was like, okay, when might it be? But actually, on balance, they have been working hard, and I have been helping them, and the app's much better, so I should say that as well. Now, last question, because the clock is on us. Maybe one of the most important questions for people listening. There are many people who come across inaccessible systems, be it on the web or an app or something, and they want to try to tell the provider what it is, but they don't always know how to verbalize that. You know, if you're not techie, it's very difficult. My screen reader won't work with this, but that doesn't give the people much info. How can people advocate for themselves, and is that something that you guys can support?
We see this all the time, and this is a really complex issue. So there's a couple of points I'd like to raise. First off, we see, even if organisations do have a clear contact route, so if they say email us, right, we see a survivorship bias quite a lot, because often those contact routes themselves aren't accessible. So people who have problems with, you know, parts of the system also have problems with the contact route, so they can't even complain. So we get a lot of people saying to us, oh well, we don't have any disabled users, or we never have any complaints about disability or lack of accessibility in our services. And then we go and check their communications route, and that doesn't work. I think the best advice I can give is find any way to raise this with them. You know, whether it's through the regulations that are available, escalating through the Equality Advisory and Support Service, or the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, or just getting in touch with someone. It doesn't have to be technical. Ask if you can speak to one of the web team, or one of their disability support teams, or one of your student support teams.
Is it good if you can? I'm not suggesting everybody can do this, but is it good if you can to say something like, listen, I'm happy to help you if I can, help you put this right. I'm happy to sit down with you.
I think that's brilliant.
Because I mean, that sometimes.
I think that's wonderful, and it's brilliant that you're happy to offer that. You know, I think, depending on the size of the company, you should charge them for your time. I think user testing. You know, I'd be really interested to talk to any company. Say, well, when you designed this thing, who did you check with to make sure it was all going to be okay and that it works well? I think it's very telling by their answers to that how far you're going to get with them in terms of using that platform, but also in terms of their ongoing customer service.
From a user research perspective, this is something I see a lot from other hats I wear. Finding a wider pool of users with additional access needs to test services is a constant struggle for many organisations, and that many fall into the rut of testing things with the same six people, some of which might be internal, and this introduces bias in the way that those users use their assistive tech to navigate those services. Anyone that's willing to donate some of their time, or charge for it, as Ben says, depending on the size of the organisation, you know, is a massive asset that any organisation who's looking to check their services for accessibility should snap your arm off to take you up on that opportunity.
Okay. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because there are so many services. I sometimes feel, guys, you know, I feel we're at a point where we go, oh, this is great, you know, I can use so many services, and then something comes up and throws a curveball. You say, oh my God, there's still all this... There's still these accessibility issues that loom, and they sometimes loom at the time we need to do something most quickly. and they can be very frustrating. So I appreciate all that you're doing in this space to keep banging the drum for people and for coming on the show today at very, very short notice. But before we go, Georgia, we have to go back to the communications person. How can people get in touch with you guys? Where can they find your website, all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, you can find our website at www.alllabel.co.uk. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter as well, under at alllabel. We're always welcome for inquiries and messages and interactions. Really enjoy that.
All right, brilliant. Ben, George and Georgia, it's been a pleasure to catch up with the three of you. Appreciate you taking the time, and keep doing what you're doing, because clearly you're doing it very well. And again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Many thanks to George, Ben and Georgia there. Thoroughly enjoyed catching up with those guys. Really interesting, isn't it? And all that they've been doing during COVID, and indeed lots more that they want to do. I want to keep checking in with those guys, I think, and definitely another repeat visit, I think, is in order in the very near future. Well, that's all we've got time for today. We're back in 2 weeks' time, though. So until then, from Stuart Lawler and everybody at Sight and Sound Technology, thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay well, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.